From the Sky News Centre at 5, an Islamic faith school has been told its policy of segregating boys from girls is unlawful. Andy Hayes reports.
The Al Hijra School in Birmingham keeps boys and girls aged 9 to 16 apart for all lessons, breaks, school clubs and trips for religious reasons. But the Court of Appeal has ruled its policy is contrary to the Equality Act. Ofsted's chief inspector has called the school's actions discrimination and says it's failing to prepare pupils for life in modern Britain. The ruling will affect other schools which have a similar policy.
The director, Quentin Tarantino, says he's heartbroken over the allegations against his friend Harvey Weinstein. American actress Rose McGowan is the latest woman to accuse the producer of rape, a claim he denies. The Chancellor has described the EU as the enemy in the Brexit negotiations. Philip Hammond has also urged his colleagues to stop squabbling and focus on getting the best outcome.
We're all signed up to the Prime Minister's Lancaster House speech. We're all behind the speech that she made in Florence. The enemy, the opponents, are out there on the other side of the table. Those are the people that we have to negotiate with. We have to negotiate hard to get the very best deal for Britain.
He's since tweeted he regrets using a poor choice of words, saying we will work with our friends and partners in the EU. Uber says it hopes to continue constructive discussions with Transport for London after lodging an appeal over its licence to operate in the city. A decision's expected in December. In football, Scottish Premiership side Hamilton say they've lost a substantial sum of money after being targeted by an elaborate fraud. Chairman Les Gray says they're working with Police Scotland and their bank to try to recover the funds. And a sacked security worker who spent the night in the roof space of a Tesco Extra in protest has been arrested. Adam Jammer live-streamed parts of his day-long demonstration on Facebook, occasionally shouting at bewildered shoppers. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping us review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for Central Ward here in Bristol, Kai Dudd. Good old Donald Trump wants to break up Obama's peace accord with Iran, and he's pulled out of UNESCO. Actually, Hollywood pulled out by default ages ago. Trump must be itching for a war because he's upping the rhetoric on North Korea too. So we look at Iran and also the original 1950s Korean War. And sonic attack on the US embassy in Cuba. Or is it just an outrageous lie and excuse to kick Cuban diplomats out of Washington? One of the great wonders of this show is every once in a while we fall on a Friday the 13th. And this October is a special anniversary, 710 years to the day, in fact, since the French king, Philip the Fair, ordered dawn arrests of one of the most bloodthirsty cults the world has ever seen. The Knights Templar ever go away or just change their spots? Oh, and by the way, what has Henry Kissinger been up to recently? We asked whether there are lessons to be learned from these historic campaigns in the Middle East, with thousands duped into the campaign by the forged letter of Prester John back in medieval times, which said the Saracens had to be defeated to break through to a fictional kingdoms of Christians in India. And also we look at modern Israel as a crusader state and examine the cult of the assassins. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and dry. Then this weekend, highs around 21. Still quite warm, isn't it? Mainly cloudy with some sunny spells. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, sunny spells and some showers. Very windy, though, at times next week. And next weekend, that's the 21st and 22nd of October, highs down a little bit to 16 with sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast, slightly interrupted by theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour Councillor for Central Ward, Kai Dudd. Hi, Kai. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, welcome. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me on. Second time on.
You're very welcome, Kai. Tell us a little bit about your role on the HR committee, because this is it's kind of overlooked a lot of the time, HR. It's really important to make sure you've got good staff. It's also a place where you often find manipulation going on, where people get the people they want on, not necessarily the best people for the job.
So I suppose, in effect, the council HR committee is the employer. So obviously we're all taxpayers. We employ council officers on behalf of everybody in the city, and that HR committee looks at remuneration for senior officers. It also looks at the wider pay policy as well for the whole council. So I suppose those are the key roles. It also can deal with industrial relation issues on the council as well. So if any of the unions have got problems,
so
if they can raise
it. Have you had phone calls from the Bristol Post this week?
The Bristol Post have been in touch, and Radio Bristol this week, yeah.
Because there's a headline in the Post this week: three new Bristol City Council bosses could each earn more than the former chief executive's £150,000 salary. So obviously a lot of us paying our council taxes, some people with no money, maybe soon being forced to pay this tax, are wondering, well, what is this so-called excuse for getting rid of the chief executive because she's costing too much, and then employing three people that are being paid more?
So there's a document coming to the HR committee next Thursday with a proposal around new pay structures and a new management structure. So this is just their proposals at the moment. The council have, with this new structure, the council have saved £750,000 from that structure. Proposals to get rid of chief exec and have three new strategic directors. At the moment, we've got five on template, so that's a reduction of two. These three individuals will be doing, they'll have beefed up portfolios and briefs. So the proposal is to pay them anything from what they're currently paid up to, I believe it's 165, depending on if they can prove that, you know, that's what the market conditions are at the moment.
There's quite a lot of taxpayers out there thinking, what about, I'll do it for 50 grand.
Yeah, well, they can apply. There's obviously a process to go through. These will be vacancies, so if people think they can do the job, they should apply.
There's also some big questions about the appointment of the chief executive, Julia, what was her second name? I can never remember it.
Anna Klonowski,
yeah, yeah. Earlier this year, because she's just been given a payoff. I think, is it £60,000?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if that's. I don't think she has been given a payoff. What I've heard is that she's left with whatever she was contractually entitled to. So I don't think that's a payoff. I think you're talking about notice pay and things like that. So I haven't seen the figure, what she's left with. It's just a figure that's out there. But I don't believe it's that much.
Well, I mean, okay, so this is from earlier in the week. Bristol City Council is accused of letting fat cats milk the system after the former chief executive has given a payment of £70,000. But the thing is, she hasn't really done what she's supposed to do. She's been in for just over the 6 months,
yeah.
Which I imagine means that she's entitled to a lot more money because she's gone past her probationary period. Now, this is all very well, but it doesn't look as if she was even appointed in the correct fashion. Now, you were chair of that committee, and there were all sorts of allegations flying around about whether she was appointed in the right way.
Yeah, I wasn't the chair of the committee at the time.
Well, you are now, okay.
Yeah, so I'm the chair now. So I was appointed chair after the AGM.
I mean, let's just be specific about the allegations, and you might be able to help us with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you might not if you weren't chair at the time. One is that the people who were making the decision hadn't actually got the necessary training in doing that job of appointing people like a chief executive, spending all this large amounts of our money, and another that initial meeting wasn't minuted, and another one that there was inducements given to one of the people on the committee by the mayor to agree to Anna's appointment if they were given a position on the cabinet. So there are several allegations out there about this being basically the Labour mayor has decided he wants this person in, and he's just really forcing the committee to get the person he wants rather than let them make their own decision.
Well, I mean, they're all allegations. I've not seen any evidence to support that. It's just come from, I believe, two individuals that sat through that process at the time. A lot of that process is meant to be confidential anyway, because you're dealing with people's contractual rights and employment rights.
The public will be grateful to people like Gary Hopkins for coming out with this, if there's any truth to it. I mean, surely that's part of what an opposition has to... I mean, the Labour Party's running Bristol, and that's the job of the opposition, is to say, hang on a minute, they haven't done this right.
Yeah, I suppose so, but I think when it comes to HR matters and the HR committee... as I said before, you're in effect the employer, and you have to behave like the employer. So people have got rights to, privacy and confidentiality. If your employment contract was aired in the public, then I'm sure you'd maybe think about suing the people that did that.
Well,
so,
actually, I'm quite happy for the volunteer contract here to be aired.
Okay.
But look, also, I think it's the reason there's so much focus on Anna and on what's happening since then and the way the new system's being brought in is because these people, not only are they spending our money that we have to pay them in tax, otherwise we go to jail. It's just the basic fact that they're there on a very high salary to perform a public service. There is this kind of creeping move in the local government world and in government generally towards running councils like businesses. And that is, I think, one of the reasons why people are looking very carefully at chief executives and chief executive pays. We've had all this hoo-ha in Bath recently about the way the university is paying some of its senior people as well.
Well, I think somebody made the analogy with football managers. So you've got these pool of chief execs that last on average about 2-3 years somewhere. And then they just seem to leave with a payoff and then find another job somewhere else and then leave with a pay. So that, I think there's a sort of a systemic problem across the whole country. But also I think the potentially the biggest problem with senior people at this level of the council is the sort of lack of performance management. I think that's the key problem. Maybe not so much what they're paid. We still have the 1 in 10 pay ratio in Bristol City Council. I believe we're the only one of the core cities that has that, and that's quite an important thing to members on the HR committee, that nobody can be paid 10 times more than the lowest paid person in the council. So we have got some good policies, but I think where we've been potentially poor in the past is around performance management. We don't have the proper systems in place to manage these people properly.
But the thing is, while services in the city are collapsing, I think that's fair to say, collapsing. I mean, we'll be hearing more about that later. Anna Klonowski is going to get a new extension to her house with her £70,000.
I don't know if that figure's true.
I'll put a link up on our show page to the story. It's in the Bristol Post this week. Bristol City Council accused of letting fat cats milk the system after former chief executive was given £70,000 payment. She lasted just 7 months in the role.
Was in private eye, though, wasn't it? So
now a councillor says some people think that council fat cats are milking the system. Yeah, well, Private Eye refused to print the Jimmy Savile story, even though it was true. So what does that say about Private Eye? Well, sometimes they're alleged. I mean, if Anna doesn't agree with this, then she can sue them, can't she? So anyhow, also, you're involved with the Communication Workers Union, which you might think was something to do with journalism, but it isn't, is it?
No, so I'm as well as being a councillor, I'm the chair of the Communication Workers in Bristol, Communication Workers Union in Bristol. And obviously we represent people in Royal Mail. We've recently got a industrial action ballot against Royal Mail. It smashed the Tory anti-trade union law. So we got an 89% yes vote on a 71% turnout. So it absolutely smashed the barriers that the Tories have put in front of us. And this week, Royal Mail went to court and got an injunction against the strike. We named dates next week. So we were due to go out Thursday, Friday and Saturday next week, and Royal Mail was successful in getting a court injunction against that democratic mandate.
Okay, well, look, two questions, right? Yeah. First of all, of course, it's appalling that the High Court is saying that a democratically agreed strike can't go ahead. I mean, that's the sort of thing you expect in fascist Spain, or, you know, in an authoritarian country of one sort or another, China maybe, not here in Britain. So, but anyway, yeah, I'm going to ask you one of the things you very rarely hear about on these. All the talk seems to be, oh, what's the effect of the strike going to be? What is the strike exactly about, Kai?
So it all stems back to Royal Mail being privatised on the cheap 3 years ago. At the time, obviously, the union was campaigning against it. It happened. So what the union did is it signed a pretty good collective agreement with Royal Mail at the time, got a good pay rise, and there was a bit of stability. That's due to expire. So we started negotiating about all the issues that came out of that. But what became apparent is that Royal Mail have finally come back with a bill for that collective agreement, and they now want to do all the things that privatised industries want to do. They want to franchise off the workforce. They want to bring in new contracts for new starters, so they're paid a lot less than the existing workforce. They want to rob our pension scheme, so pay more in, work longer, get less out of it. And also, they've got no strategy for the future of the company. They don't want to grow the business. They don't want to explore new products and services. They're all about asset stripping. They're all about saving money. I believe since privatisation, Royal Mail have sold over £1 billion worth of property. They're looking to sell Mount Pleasant in London. That's worth hundreds of millions of pounds. And that seems to be their only approach. Asset strip, cut costs, and they're not interested in growing the business. And really, generally speaking, it's about whether there's a job worth having at the end of this dispute, really. That's what it's about.
I mean, it does sound to me a bit like self-immolation by Royal Mail, the idea really being that there are people running it that may have shares in one of the competitors, like TNT.
I don't know what shares they hold.
They seem to be operating in the interests of the competitors to Royal Mail rather than in Royal Mail itself.
Well, they definitely own a lot of Royal Mail shares, and obviously the more money they take from the workers, the more their shares go up, and the more money they get at the top level on the board. So I think that's where they're coming from, and maybe they see it as a quick buck. You know, they're not going to be around for 10, 20 years. They're only going to be there for 4 or 5 years. Get in there, strip the costs out, make the money and move on.
So what happens if you do what the Catalans did and just ignore the court and say, well, we've just had a democratic ballot and actually we believe in democracy and you obviously don't, so we're going to go on strike anyway?
I'm personally up for that, but I think there's dangers with that people at trade union headquarters have to look at, because if you go unofficial, then the union's liable for costs against the employer, costs against customers of Royal Mail.
Well, if the union officially denounces it?
So potentially, but it's very hard to organise national unofficial action. You probably need to get that coordinated. And so I think it's very hard to suggest that it was spontaneous and it came from the shop floor. So I think we may potentially be in some difficulty there, but that there are offices in Bristol and across the country that are absolutely sick to the teeth of what Royal Mail are up to. So I wouldn't be surprised if some offices walked out because they've just had enough with what they've had to put up with.
Could you just give us an idea of the sorts of things that people are coming to you as branch secretary here in Bristol from across the... I mean, we all rely on Royal Mail. Every one of us. I mean, sometimes we're a bit annoyed with all the junk mail that comes as well. But and I imagine some of the people that are doing the deliveries are too. But generally speaking, can you just give us an idea of some of the things that people have come to you about over the last few years since it was all privatised?
So as the old adage is, you know, it's all about cutting costs. So it's getting people to do more work for less money. So you've got people on deliveries that are being forced to work past their time. If they go over their time, they're being told that they can't claim overtime. The workload's gone through the roof, and it's unmanageable in many offices. And if they cut off and say I can't deliver this within the time, and they bring work back to the office, they get bullied by their managers. So it's kind of issues like that alongside.
Sounds a bit like Amazon.
Yeah, it's headed, and with the Royal Mail propaganda that we receive as employees, It's all about referencing what other employers are doing. So you look at Hermes, Yodel, and it's all companies with a business model of zero-hour contracts, minimum wage, no employment rights. Royal Mail are saying this is what we should be like. And I think it's sort of symbolic of what's going on in the wider economy. Actually, you've got this race to the bottom in employment rights, wages. It's all about the lowest common denominator. And I think postal workers in Royal Mail have had enough. And I think we'll be the group of workers that sort of starts the, you know, the ball going in the other direction, hopefully.
I mean, is there anything we, the hundreds of thousands of public that you serve every day, can do?
I think we're a well-organised union. You know, we got a massive mandate there from the strike ballot. You could all vote for a Labour government. That would probably help and get rid of all the anti-trade union laws. But if it does come to us actually being able to go on strike, please turn up to the picket lines, show your support. Bring cakes, bring, I don't know, sausage rolls, whatever. It always goes down well. And just show us that solidarity, because we're a strong union, and we stick together. But it's good to know that the public are on side as well. So there's more sort of moral support.
But even if you were on strike, what would one day not working actually achieve?
Well, we timetabled a 48-hour dispute. I think you're
okay,
right.
Okay, 2 days. All right.
I think you're right. A 24-hour is just like a bank holiday to Royal Mail, isn't it? So it wouldn't have had much effect. But I think you have to start off with something like a 48-hour and build up from that. So it's almost like firing a warning shot, that first action, 48 hours. You know, we're serious. And you can build it up. And I think we would have done. We would have targeted potentially key days like Black Friday, Manic Monday, key dates around the Christmas period.
Do you know why the High Court has ruled this illegal? I mean, what excuse have they got?
I mean, what they're saying is due to the collective agreement that we have with Royal Mail, in it there's a clause about bringing in outside mediation. Now, we believe that clause was actually exercised because ACAS had been involved, and also a former chair of ACAS was called in to mediate within the talks. But apparently the High Court judge ruled that wasn't properly adhered to, so they were granted an interim injunction. And I believe the test of that is, in granting it, is who would be financially damaged the most if it was issued or if it wasn't issued. And what the judge decided was that Royal Mail would be most affected if he allowed the strike to go ahead. So I suppose it's contract law. We think we adhere to the agreement. Royal Mail have actually breached the agreement because they've served notice on the pension scheme. So we're saying that's executive action. So they've, but obviously, you know, you've got a High Court judge. You've got laws that are brought in by the establishment. I suppose the High Court judge was probably a public schoolboy, went to Oxford. You know, who are they going to back? Do they have much in common with the postal worker, or are they going to back the moneyed interest? So
I suppose the question here, and I'll bring you in here, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, is there anything going to be much left of the Royal Mail after this attack from within by its own management, by the time if there's any possibility of Labour getting in? Because I know the Labour Party does actually want to renationalise it.
Well, if you think about it, the taxpayer lost millions of pounds when Royal Mail was sold at less than its real value. And that's, people should be pretty angry about that. That was not justifiable. I'd just like to ask Kai, I mean, presumably you're appealing this decision by this judge and saying, well, we our interpretation is there a higher court that you can appeal to?
I don't know if we are, actually. From what I've been told, potentially not. Mm-hmm. But there's a briefing next week, so I think we'll get an update next week. What we are looking, because under the current trade union law that was brought in about 6 months ago, the lifetime of a ballot is 6 months.
Right.
So what I think one of the things we're trying to say is that the clock for that should start from when the judge made that judgment, rather than from when we got the result. Personally, I think we should look at appealing it, because obviously Royal Mail were in breach of the agreement anyway, because it was executive action to serve notice on the pension scheme.
Yeah, Kai, what about the pay of the chief executive and top managers at Royal Mail?
It's gone through the roof, absolutely gone through the roof. I think Moira Green's on about £3 million a year. She's got getting on for hundreds, thousands of shares, I believe. It's up.
So she's a kind of, you know, we had that headline on the Bristol Post about milking the, but she seems to be sitting there just basically asset stripping and milking Royal Mail. I mean, this is almost like we've got an oligarchy here going on, Martin.
Well, yes. I'm astonished that they're able to get away with this. I mean, as you say, you've fulfilled all of the basic criteria of balloting for strikes, which is pretty, you know, dubious anyway. And then they say that you haven't brought in arbitration.
Seems to me it's a bit like in Spain, you have, where the courts are just an excuse to impose political power.
Well, I would argue, actually, the human right to withdraw your labour trumps any kind of contract law.
Well, it does. Yeah, it does.
In the past, we could think of appealing to the European Court of Human Rights around.
Well, you still
like that,
can. We are still in the EU, by the way. You know. Anyway, let's go on to look at Prime Minister's questions this week, because they're back. Martin is smiling, of course. No, he's not actually. He's looking very sad because you don't like Prime Minister's questions time, Martin, do you? But this, it does give. In fact, one of the only opportunities to get into the national news, some of the most important events, because Jeremy Corbyn brought up this bringing in of universal credit, which, even though various reports have said that it's going to be a disaster, they're deciding to do it anyway.
Jeremy Corbyn
recognises there are problems with it. The IPPR and the Child Poverty Action Group estimate it's going to put another 200,000 children into poverty. Last month, apparently a dozen Conservative MPs wrote to the Work and Pensions Secretary calling for a pause. Perhaps they should have listened to people like Georgina, who contacted me this week, and I quote from Georgina, who says this: "All summer, we were left with no money to survive, as it just stopped abruptly. We would have lost everything if it weren't for my family. Others cannot rely on family and are facing eviction. I urge the Prime Minister, show some leadership, pause universal credit and stop driving up poverty, debt and homelessness, because that is what it does."
First of all, can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, I'd be happy to look at the case of Georgina, if he would like to send me those particular details. As I have just said, and once again, I did actually refer to this in my previous answer, had the Right Honourable Gentleman listened to it, it is possible for those who are in need to get advance payments. The number of those getting advance payments has increased from 35% to 50%, the majority, just over 50%. So we are seeing the system being improved and performance improving. But let's just think about the Labour Party's record on this whole issue of welfare. Under the Labour Party, 1.4 million people spent most of the last decade trapped on out-of-work benefits. Under the Labour Party, the number of households where no... Under the Labour...
Order. Prime Minister's response must be heard. Prime Minister.
Under the Labour government, the number of households where no member had ever worked nearly doubled. The welfare bill went up by 60% in real terms, which cost every household an extra £3,000 a year. That's not the way to run a system. That's the way to have a system that is failing ordinary working people.
Now, Kai, what do you make of that? Because there is what she's saying there is that we've got a whole load of people who are trapped on benefits. This is one way of getting them off the benefits.
Well, it wasn't very strong and stable, was it, to be honest with you? One of my biggest concerns, actually, is the move to monthly payments. I think it's fortnightly at the moment.
Well, that's monthly if you're on universal credit.
That's one of my biggest concerns with it, because... most people will spend that money in the first week, and so they'll have no money for 3 weeks.
Now,
what,
Martin,
are
you're on universal credit, aren't you?
I was until quite recently. Yeah.
Okay. How did you find it?
Terrible. I mean, the 6 week gap is just an administrative thing. I mean, why have a 6 week gap? That means that people fall into the hands of loan sharks straight away, and they never pay that money back. And all the evidence shows that people on universal credit have much higher rent arrears. And the other thing, of course, is that private landlords won't rent to people on universal credit because the money's paid to the beneficiary and not directly to the landlords, unlike housing benefit used to be. And the other thing about universal credit is, it's guaranteed to increase homelessness. It's absolutely vindictive in its whole approach to people. And Theresa May going on about the Labour Party and what that was, because there was a crash of the banking system and loads of people became unemployed. There was a recession, remember? And then the economy gradually recovered. Then they started to push it down again.
You keep saying crash. I always say bailout.
All right, bailout. But the point is that's why during the Labour government there were more people on benefits, because there was a huge international financial crisis.
Well, and we've got more people in work, as they say, but more people in work poverty.
It's quite clear with rents where they are now in the private sector that many people are simply going to be better off on benefits.
So Theresa May's got to be a piece of paper on in front of her desk saying universal credit at the top. The main words that should leap out to her are 200,000 children will be put in poverty if you sign this, and she signs on the dotted line.
This is Ian Duncan Smith's brainchild. It should have been rolled out years ago, but every time they try and roll it out, because of these the poor design and the punitive philosophy behind it, it's not workable.
Just not enough money, Martin.
Well, it's not enough money, and they're deliberately trying to make it difficult to claim.
There is not enough money to pay all these benefits.
Oh, that's not true. There's plenty of money to bail the banks out, and we've not actually cut the deficit in the timescale they pretended to cut it, because they tried to cut the deficit, if you remember. The economy started to go down the drain. They lost the country's AAA credit rating. Can I just remind people listening to this show, they lost the country's AAA credit rating from trying to cut too fast, and now we still haven't got rid of the deficit, and we're not going to get rid of it because it's going to be a further crash.
Anyway, Jeremy Corbyn wasn't the only one complaining about universal credit. There was also a Conservative MP.
Aidy Allen!
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I fear the mall won't be for me. I'm afraid I must return to the subject of universal credit. But perhaps the difference on this side of the House and that side of the House is we believe in the transformative properties of it, and we want it to work. And work it will, but we have to get it right. And I thank the Secretary of State on Monday for promising to advertise more widely that advances were available to claimants. But there are many of us on this side of the House that feel that more people taking those advances must surely mean that the inbuilt six-week wait just doesn't work. Yeah. My question is to the Prime Minister, would she please consider meeting with me so I can explain to her why, if we reduce that six-week wait, we will do a better job of supporting those just about managing families who are struggling to make ends meet and have no savings to cover them over that period.
My honourable friend makes the important point about the fundamental benefits of universal credit, but she's right, of course, and that's why, as I said, the DWP is continuing to look at the performance and how it's operating. I'm happy to meet with my honourable friend to look at this issue. We recognise, she's mentioned the advance payments. Of course, as she says, it is important that those who need those advance payments are aware of that. And that's why it's not just about advertising, but actually making sure that job centre staff are trained and they're being retrained to ensure they're aware of what they can do to help people. And in terms of the advance payments, they can be with people within 5 days or in an emergency on the very same day. But I'm happy to meet to discuss with my honourable.
Yeah, I think every Tory MP obviously holds surgeries and that, and the reality's coming home to roost, isn't it? They've obviously got people coming in in dreadful situations, and some of them obviously got a bit of a conscience. I think it's about time they bloody did something and maybe crossed the floor. I think it's a similar case with Charlotte Leslie. You know, she talks a good game, but then you just have to look at how they vote on legislation. So they voted for this. They may moan about it, but you have to look at the way they voted on this issue, you know?
Also, she won't come in on this programme at the moment. Anyway, let's hope there's an invite out there. I invited her again last week. Haven't heard anything back.
Is that Charlotte Leslie?
That's Kerry McCarthy from Bristol East, the Labour MP. But she was in Prime Minister's Questions, so we do get a little snippet of her from time to time. And here she is talking about meningitis vaccines.
Kerry McCarthy.
Thank you. In the past 18 months, two students from St Brendan's Sixth Form College in my constituency, Izzy Gentry and George Zagrafu, tragically died from meningitis B. And only this week we heard reports of the death from suspected meningitis of another Bristol pupil from Orchard School too. The free vaccinations for babies introduced 2 years ago are, of course, very welcome, but came far too late to save Izzy and George. So will the Prime Minister do more to raise awareness of meningitis and extend free vaccinations to today's teenagers, which is the group that after babies is most at risk?
First of all, of course, we send our deep condolences to the families and friends of all those students in the Honourable Lady's constituency who have died as a result of contracting meningitis. And I think the point she raises about raising awareness of meningitis is a very valuable one, and is one that we do need to continue to do. I think very often, you know, decisions are taken by government, such as on the vaccination that is already in place, and it's very easy to think that's a job done, but actually we need to continue to look to see how we can ensure that we don't see these deaths from meningitis in the future.
Yeah, sounds like a laudable thing, doesn't it? But the thing is that we've got several people who've died from meningitis B here in Bristol. The only thing is that they're starting to mount, and there's a very large pharmaceutical lobby that's trying to get more and more of these vaccines injected into kids at a very, very young age. In the US, we're now up to 70 injections into children by the time they reach a year old. And there is even talk this week of the respiratory RSV vaccine to be trialled on unborn children. So it seems like there's a sort of bit of an epidemic of vaccines, new vaccines available. But, you know, when we get to the stage of 70 vaccines by the time you're a year old, Martin, what do you make of this? Because there is a big financial incentive, isn't there, on the big pharmaceutical companies to get public health to be paying for all these vaccines.
Well, that's certainly true in the US, where, you know, health is run as an industry for profit. In theory, in the national health system, decisions about vaccinations should be based on medical grounds and medical grounds alone. But inevitably, there's some pressure from pharmaceutical companies on the NHS. And there's a case, of course, for nationalising the pharmaceutical industry, because that's where most NHS money goes, is buying drugs produced by the private sector. And if you're going to have a non-market-based system, then you should produce all of those drugs for cost by nationalised industries. And that, of course, is what the developing countries have been pushing for many years in the World Trade Organization, and blocked by Britain and the US because the pharmaceutical industry is based in the north.
Kai, we've got, it's a laudable cause that Kerry's saying here. We've got kids dying from meningitis B, but where do you draw the line? How many injections are you going to give to a child before they're able to actually decide for themselves whether they want an injection or whether they think they need one?
Well, generally speaking, vaccination's good public health, isn't it? And I agree with Martin, it has to be based solely on the medical evidence and the medical advice. So I do have some concerns about the USA. So 70 vaccinations, as you say, is that really necessary? I don't know. I think you have to. What ones do you think aren't necessary? That would be interesting to hear from.
Well, I don't know. It's just that it might be that 99.99% of these vaccinations are unnecessary because the kids aren't going to contract the disease. But it just seems that this is a massive growth industry anyway in the pharmaceutical sector. They're looking to get as many new vaccination programs as possible to boost their shareholders.
Well, it's got to be based on independent medical advice, isn't it? Uninfluenced by private industry. I don't know. I think there's lots of very committed public servants in the NHS that have got people's medical need and public health at heart. So why don't we let them make the decisions?
I think it's very much something for GPs. Think about, is this really necessary, this vaccination? Is it useful? Is it helpful? Because there are certainly a lot of GPs over in the US who are saying that there's far too many vaccinations, and this is just lining the pockets of the pharmaceutical industry. Anyway, the spectre of conspiracy has been raised this week by MI5 dossier on establishment burying of Cyril Smith child sex abuse evidence. Now, this is to do with several years ago, the press asking the Director of Public Prosecutions if there were proceedings against Cyril Smith being considered. And they then said, no, there aren't. Whereas actually, in fact, there were. And this is an MI5 dossier that's come out this week about Cyril Smith. In the Daily Mail, it says MI5 intelligence on allegations of paedophilia by the late politician Cyril Smith raises a spectre of collusion, which could explain why he escaped justice and inquiries heard. A dossier of information on the Liberal MP was held by MI5 and has been disclosed by the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse. Laura Hoyano, representing 7 alleged victims of Smith, asked in her opening statement to the inquiry, why was MI5 involved at all? It came as the Crown Prosecution Service criticised some elements of a decision by the DPP not to press sexual abuse charges against Cyril Smith in 1970, despite allegations and police investigations dogging the career of the 29-stone politician. He was never prosecuted. Now, in the background to this, we've got several press at the time, Martin, asking about Cyril Smith. They'd heard rumours that they was considering prosecution against him, and yet they were told there was nothing there when there was.
Well, the suspicion has got to be that because he was such a big wig and, you know, such a heavyweight politically and in every other way, that he was protected by the police, etc. And that's a legitimate suspicion, isn't it?
Kai?
So are you saying he knew where all the bodies were?
Well, no, we're talking about Cyril Smith now.
Yeah, I'm just metaphorically speaking.
Oh, yeah.
So he knew where everything, he knew where the wet, tangled web led, so they didn't want to take him down because he would take other people
well,
down.
Well, I think it's more to the point that he was just a very senior politician.
Well, I think Kai's making a really important point there. As soon as this starts to come into the courts, suddenly Cyril Smith is going to start saying, well, there's this and this and this. He may well come out with all sorts of other... I mean, obviously, paedophiles don't... especially VI paedophiles don't work alone, do they?
No, and it may be that he was part... I mean, it was clear he had a relationship with the children's home in his constituency where he used to go in and basically abuse boys. That was, and it was all pretty well known. I suspect that what was going on there, I'm just suspecting, because I haven't got full information, obviously, is that basically it was well known to the authorities what he was doing, and a blind eye was turned because he was such a prominent, you know, important political figure in Rochdale.
So both of you, I'll put both of you, this is the key question, I think. Why did the Director of Public Prosecutions lie to the press when the press were asking, are you considering charging Smith? Martin?
They were covering it up.
There don't seem to be any consequences for lying, do they? Even about something so serious.
That was in 1970, was it?
1970, yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, in those days, I mean, the establishment still covers up its misdeeds. And the 1970s, they were able even more so to do so.
And it was Sir Norman Skelhorn. He concluded there was not enough evidence to prosecute him, despite a police report that warned Smith was sheltering behind a veneer of respectability. This is, you know, it does seem, though, that we are concentrating a lot on these people who are now dead and can't obviously face justice. Whereas some of these could be going on today, Kai.
Well, I think there is a point there about the establishment. You know, at the top of many professions, especially the legal profession, it's people who went to the same schools, went to the same universities, drink in the same clubs. So you can imagine favours are called in from time to time. You know, I'm a little bit suspicious about this, you know, Royal Mail court case, you know, what was going on there. So I think it's just part of the culture of this country, really, that people do deals with each other at the top of society.
Are you saying Britain is corrupt?
Well,
perish the thought.
There's a lot of legal corruption in this country.
Anyway, I mean, another related story, this is in the Bristol Post this week, child sex allegations against Sir Edward Heath came from the Bristol region. The Wiltshire Police looked at 42 allegations in total from around the UK, of which one was from our area. Now, I'm wondering whether this possibly was that interview we aired a few years ago, Martin, with Michael Shrimpton, who said that that Heath had been actually abusing boys down on his boat Morning Cloud in Jersey. And these were actually kids who were from the Hope de la Grenne Children's Home, and they were then murdered. That is an allegation, but it does explain why so many boys disappeared from that home. I mean, the police were digging up the grounds, for goodness sake, digging up the basement, trying to find them.
Well, I think there are two aspects to this. One is that people are just being protected because they are who they are and they know who they know. The other is the use of paedophile blackmail by the intelligence services. The Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland was at one stage going to be excluded from the inquiry into VI paedophilia on the grounds, get this, that it wasn't part of British jurisdiction. Somebody should tell Gerry Adams that. But of course it was included in the end, and the evidence is pretty overwhelming. The MI5 were using it as a honey trap. Basically, people went there to have sex with underage boys and they were videoed, and then MI5 used those videos to blackmail politicians in Northern Ireland. And I think that the evidence that the Secret Services do engage in this kind of stuff is overwhelming, frankly. Well, and it could well be that Heath was being blackmailed in exactly that way.
Yeah, Ted Heath lived in Salisbury. He was under armed guard there. I remember going past his house in the Cathedral Crescent, where there was some guy who would step out with a rifle from behind a tree if you came too close to the railings. And this week there's an excellent article in the Daily Mail about this. Ted Heath, police chief, calls for new inquiry into Westminster child sex ring covered up by the establishment. Now, this is the chief constable of Wiltshire Constabulary, Mike Veal, and many people in the world of the child sex abuse survivors are looking to him as someone who is one of the only police chiefs in the country who's really looking after their interests and not been captured by the establishment. So he's saying that in Devizes that he's actually calling for an inquiry into the sinister claims of a Westminster child sex ring, which is not being investigated and not been exposed still, because many of these claims were included in the investigation he did Operation Conifer, which came out last week, the day after the end of the Conservative Party conference. So he's called for a new inquiry to lance the boil of sinister claims that a Westminster child sex ring was covered up by the establishment. He said he could have spent two or three more years investigating Sir Edward Heath if his officers had been allowed to dig deeper. And he attacked the sickening suggestion that the sexual abuse of rent boys and those ravaged by drugs or alcohol was less serious than cases involving wealthy people from Middle England. So quite an interesting chat, Mike Veal. And I think a big pat on the back for him for having the courage to come out with this. So few people who are doing these inquiries seem to have that courage. I would say, from my experience in Salisbury, working there for the BBC in 1992, that we were completely, and this is other reporters and I, were shown evidence that there was child sexual abuse going on in care homes. And those care homes were being run by the deputy leader of the Conservative group on Salisbury District Council. So we never made any direct connection to Ted Heath. But this does seem to be a pattern. Maybe I'll ask you about this first, Kai. That much of this abuse, including in Rotherham, etc., has been going on systematically in care homes, where kids are taken away from their parents, put into, in big inverted commas, care, and then sexually abused.
Well, I think the biggest scandal is a lot of this only comes out after the individuals in question have died. I think that's a scandal. And I suppose the only recourse the people do have then is a public inquiry. I don't think there's any other legal recourse that they can go down. And also, there may be some people still alive from the cover-up. The cover-up is a crime as well. So there's probably people not involved in the paedophilia, but involved in the cover-up that probably have questions to answer as well. So I think it is worthwhile the police investigating this. But again, it's very unfortunate that the actual people responsible can't be held to account in a lot of these cases.
Martin, one of the things that he said, Mike Veal, is that he's attacking this idea that the sex abuse of rent boys is less serious than that of the wealthy, because there's been criticism of saying, well, look, a lot of the people that you're interviewing here are scallywags of one sort or another, and you can't trust their evidence.
Well, one of the problems is, don't forget, homosexuality was illegal in this country till 1967, and then the age of consent was only 21. It's only come down to the same age as heterosexual age of consent quite recently. So you could say, if somebody has sex with a 19-year-old male and they're male themselves, it was strictly speaking illegal, but you could argue that perhaps that's not right. It shouldn't have been illegal. But of course, if you're talking about underage children, underage 16, because, I mean, we've got age of consent in Holland is 14. You could argue about what the age of consent should be, but there's clearly got to be one. Well, I'll come back to my earlier point. There is evidence that the intelligence services use paedophilia as a means of blackmailing mainstream politicians. So people like Heath and others, because of their proclivities, are open to blackmail.
Well, actually, what
and
you're
then
saying,
they are blackmailed, well, and then policy is well, decided on the back of that.
What I'm saying is here is that it might be that people who are blackmailable are then helped up the political system.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what they were doing at Kinkora. MI5 were basically encouraging loyalist paramilitary leaders to go in there, have sex with underage boys. They were being videoed. Then they were being shown the videos and saying, you're going to play ball, aren't you? That's what was going on.
Okay, on to another subject now. And I was struck with the Independent of two contrary articles. House one is just in the same week. House prices hit record high after rising at fastest pace in 8 months. And then in the next week, UK house prices fall for the fifth month in a row. Actually, what they're talking about really is the average house price, and London is slowing down. What's the significance of this, Martin?
Well, the housing market is bubbling around the top.
In London, it's not. It's going down now.
Yeah, that's because of the changes in legal position of foreign residents and so on. But the problem is with housing markets, they don't just stabilise. They either go up or they go down. And once they start going down, they keep going down. And at a certain point, the property bubble that's been built up by not building any social housing for 30 years and you know, encouraging everybody to get onto the housing ladder,
it's
going to burst.
Last week, Philip Hammond announced loads more money for the Help to Buy scheme.
Well, that's just basically giving money to Tory voters in marginal constituencies, free money for them. So there's no question about them having free money. Why should they get free money to buy a house when other people haven't got a house?
It's actually really the Help to Sell scheme, I would call it.
It's ridiculous that you're promoting demand and not putting money into supply, where the money obviously
needs
to go.
Okay, so let's hear from Bristol City Council. What are you doing? You actually, I think you share the central constituency with Paul Smith,
Councillor,
am I right?
Paul Smith, you've had him on the show. He's obviously
so
in a
are we going to get some nice council houses here?
Well, we're investing hundreds of millions of pounds into housing over the next 4 or 5 years. There's been council houses opened up in Lockleys. We've got more on tap that are coming in, but it's not enough, and we're still on target to stick to our manifesto pledge of 800 affordable homes on average a year by 2020. So we're still on target to hit that, but it's
Affordable homes often aren't affordable, are they?
Well, it's what we class as affordable is either shared ownership with the other half or whatever it may be, rented out to you at social rents, or social rents up to the local housing benefits cap. So what we're classing as affordable is affordable. There's other types of affordable out there, like 80% of market rate or whatever. We're not classing that as affordable.
Okay. Also, let's have a look. Well, let's go back now to Prime Minister's questions, because there's been some big decisions this week to do with British aerospace and the building of the Typhoon fighter up in Wharton, up in the north.
Mark Menzies!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Following yesterday's announcement of almost 2,000 job losses at BAE Systems, many hundreds of which are at Wharton in my constituency, where very dedicated and highly skilled people work, can the Prime Minister assure me that she will continue to ensure that she and her government does everything that she can to support export orders in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, but also to support those dedicated workers, find other alternative employment and support the wider Lancashire economy?
My honourable friend is absolutely right. This is obviously a very worrying time for workers at BAE Systems, including obviously those at Wharton in his constituency. And he raises the two issues. I can reassure him that the Department for Work and Pensions will make sure that they work with people and ensure they have all the support they need to look for new jobs. That will include the Rapid Response Service, which will help with CVs, with training and information about benefits. But we will also continue to promote our world-leading defence industry right across the globe, so companies like BAE Systems can secure contracts for UK made equipment. Just last month, my right honourable friend, the Defence Secretary, signed a statement of intent with Qatar, committing the country to the purchase of 24 Typhoons and 6 Hawks from BAE. We will continue to promote these first-class products of first-class manufacturing, such as in my honourable friend's constituency, and we will also make sure that support is given to those who do lose their jobs.
So this is 2,000 people being laid off up at British Aerospace. I mean, this is, I suppose, some of the products for these typhoon fighters, Kai, will be made at Wharton. Here in at Filton, you know, the things like Rolls-Royce engines, GKN bearings, all this sort of thing. So it does look like the aerospace industry is dying simply because the Ministry of Defence won't buy these jets.
Yeah, I mean, it's very sad. And you're talking about high-skilled, high-paid jobs, and they're the kind of jobs that school leavers can go into through apprenticeships and whatnot. So, it is very worrying, and we've had a long history of the aerospace industry in this country. And I think if you're going to have a defence policy and a defence strategy, it should be about producing and developing your own products and buying your own products first rather than going for off-the-shelf American products. I think, from what I understand, the Typhoon's a very good fighter aircraft, and it could do a lot of similar things to what the F-35 can do, which we're buying for the new aircraft carriers. So I think the government really should be developing a defence strategy that supports jobs in this country.
Martin?
I think in the long run, we're going to have an industrial policy where we wean ourselves off selling weapons of war to a country like Qatar, where they have no democratic system and they're involved in supporting jihadi terrorism, for example, in Syria and Saudi Arabia. That is actually a dead end for us. And the skills that have been developed in aerospace are going to have to be redeployed. But for that, you would need to have a plan. And we don't have a plan. The only plan we've got is the military expenditure plan. It's the same way in the US. They do have an industrial strategy. It's run from the Pentagon. The Germans and the Japanese, because they've concentrated on civilian engineering, are in a much better position than we are, because ultimately defence production is a dead end. It's dependent ultimately on government expenditure. It's not producing a better widget for the housewife.
First, one thing from earlier this year, the UK is facing massive rising costs to fix what they call the stealth fighter. Britain is being forced to pour millions of pounds into new funds into the troubled F-35 stealth fighter programme being developed in America and considered a vital part of the UK's future defences. The F-35, being built by the US in partnership with countries including the UK, is the costliest weapon ever developed. It's scheduled to go into service in the UK in 2018, full production in 2019, and a cornerstone of the UK defence, but huge problems remain unsolved, in particularly with its advanced software, on which the whole project rests. So there are some serious flaws with this. Trump announced that he was cancelling a load of orders for the F-35, and yet we're still buying them, and we're not buying the Typhoons, Martin.
Yes, I know. I take Kai's point that I think military production should be entirely nationalised. It shouldn't be any private profit basis in it. And of course, Russian military industry is entirely nationalised, which is why their kit is actually superior in many ways. Because what you've got in the NATO countries is everybody's looking for cost plus contracts, and they're looking for the most expensive and difficult way to do things. Whereas in Russia, of course, what they do, every ruble they spend on military is money they can't spend on schools. And therefore they think very carefully about what they're buying, and it looks like their kit is actually superior.
There's even talks of getting these Typhoons to make them suitable to be used on the aircraft carrier, because they're not at the moment. But it just seems to me, why spend all this money in the States? Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest, Labour Councillor for Central Ward, Kai Dudd. Join us after the news as we go on to do our best to keep ahead of the curve.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.